let's go back. Random House has been very generous in their publicity, and they've sent a biography and everything, but I don't want to just read that. I'd like to hear it from you, and I'd like to go way back to your origins, because I know you're an Easterner.
Yes, I am, yes.
Tell me about it. Where'd you grow up?
Well, I was born in New York and grew up in a place called Short Hills in New Jersey. And I don't really consider New Jersey a home because at the age of 9, I went to boarding schools, to pre-prep and then prep school. And then there was a little brief hiatus of my life where I did other things and then went back attended and graduated from Wesleyan University.
Let's look at some of the things you might have been reading as you were growing up before you went to the university, because perhaps some of the early reading that people do has an impact on their later lives. What did you like?
I liked sweeping kind of fiction. Remember Kenneth Roberts and Northwest Passage? Oh, you're too young to remember that, my word.
Anne Arundel?
Oh, yes, and Anne Arundel. Oh, my word, you do know. Yes.
Oh,
that's right, of course. Oh, you read them things. Yeah. And then, of course, Dickens. Always Dickens. As a matter of fact, I just came from a place and they gave me a lovely volume of a few books of Dickens. And let's see. Then the normal things in school that I think an awful lot of people felt they had to read. I found myself very much involved and wanting to read Thomas Hardy, Mayor of Casterbridge, things like that. And I really did kind of enjoy. So I don't really think that I was much influenced in those days. I never thought I'd be a writer.
You probably thought you were going to go into the theater, and that's exactly what you did.
Yeah, because at the age of 14, I left home very amiably, not the way some people have said in publicity, as if, you know, I, in a hostile rage, left. Not at all. I called up my mother every week and told her that I was perfectly fine. And I appeared in Broadway in Junior Miss, and then went out on the road companies of Junior Miss, Janie, and Kiss and Tell. I was 14 then. And
your parents let you go at age 14?
No, my father had passed away, and my mother thought it was a little insane, but I guess I was a little headstrong. But it was never anything the way I've heard, that he revolted and all that. Not at all. I just felt very strongly that I wanted to do this. And since all of the decent actors were drafted, I was able to get a job. It was as simple as that.
At 14? I mean, how could you get away with something like that?
Not easily. As a matter of fact, Conrad Janis was my roommate when we were traveling in Junior Miss. Do you know Conrad Janis?
No, I don't.
Oh, Lord, he was the father on Mork and Mindy, and he's a great trombone player. You may have heard of his band, and also in Front Page, the revival of Front Page a number of years ago that I was involved with. Conrad was the fellow who played the banjo. Wonderful. Wonderful actor, wonderful all-round performer. And then along came, I went back to school. Then I went into service into the Marine Corps. Came back and went straight. I went to Wesleyan University and graduated in 1951.
To your mother's relief, I would imagine.
Yes. It was a funny story. During the time of the run of Junior Miss, we were in Detroit, and I went up to Toronto, got across the border. And
Excuse me, who did you play in Junior Miss?
I played three different roles. Sterling Brown, Haskell Cummings, and somebody else who I don't... Albert Canody. These names have long since gone from my mind, but just came back. But while we were in Toronto, I went to... while we were in Detroit, I went to Toronto and tried to enlist in the Royal Canadian Air Force. I had been using another name on stage called John Holmes, and I went up there. By this time, my mother hadn't heard from me in a couple of weeks, and so she sent out a few alarms. And I'll never forget as long as I live. Here I'm filling out all these applications, seeing myself in the, you know, shooting down all the planes and this and that. I probably haven't got the brains to get into a cockpit, but nevertheless, at that time I thought I did. As I say, I was using the name Holmes, and in came a sergeant major, and he said, "Ludlum!" And I said, "Yes, no, out." That was the, after that school, what have you.
What did you study at Wesleyan?
I was the first fine arts major there.
The very first?
The very first. And as a matter of fact, Joe and I were talking about this, a publicist from Random House, that I'd been someplace else. And I went there because a friend of mine said, you know, this is an opportunity. You may like it, you may hate it. And I said, to be the first theater major in a place like Wesleyan, or first fine arts theater major, I said, that sounds great. And he said, well, before you jump, he said, I think you should know that when any university is forming a new department, it means that other departments lose a few dollars. They will be rough on you. But it was a great education. It was a wonderful experience.
That was a period, of course, 20 years before your first book, so there was a...
Oh, good Lord, yes.
Yeah. A lot of...
1951. 20 years, you're right. Yeah. I'd never thought of it that way. You're right.
There was a lot of activity that you had to go through before the first book. So what happened during that 20-year period to you?
Well, when I got out of college, I was an actor, about 7 or 8 Broadway shows and about 200 or 300 television shows. And then I became a producer. I was a producer in regional theater and on Broadway. And the only reason I became a producer was that everybody kept saying to me when I was an actor, gee, you make a good producer. And I got the message eventually. It would be better that I was behind the stage rather than on it. And so I did that until I was 40 years of age. And I'd always wanted to write, always. And only through the accident of minor, very minor, surviving, I guess you'd call it, minor success, I never felt that I had the time or the inclination and with the responsibilities to take that gamble. But then along came around 1969, I was quite bored with the theater because in those days, theater was really real estate, totally real estate. And if you put on something of any real quality, you could shoot moose in the lobby. And I was really getting a little discouraged about all that. And so I decided to take the plunge. And I was very lucky. I had a few, what we call in this business, voiceovers going. That is morally one step below theft, you know, and they run...
Pays very well, though.
Oh, yes, that's how I was able to write the first book.
squirreled away some money for this jury.
Well, it was actually a question of the residuals came in with a fair regularity. Nothing great, incidentally. I was not living high off the hog, because I had quit the theater, and... sort of threw a lot of eggs in one basket. Figuring that, frankly, I figured I'd be teaching. And
where were you living at this point?
I was living in New Jersey. And then one day, I'd written about 200 pages, 300 pages of the first book, and I gave it to a friend who gave it to an agent who invited me to a terribly expensive restaurant here in New York called Le Chauvron. And for the first time in 18 years, I didn't have to pay for lunch. And that's when I figured that possibly I was publishable.
Well, yeah. Publishing is a pretty good deal. Everything good has worked out over lunch and publishing.
Well, I never understood that, you see. When I was a producer, I simply picked up the check and usually lost the star. So it was
as a matter of fact, if you try to reach a publicist at Random House or anyplace else between 11 and 3, you're out of luck.
Oh, no, they're out. They're out. No. No, I understand that. Try to reach an editor between those hours. Same thing.
That's true.
Yes.
Well, tell me a little bit about this, the first book. That was the Scarlatti Inheritance.
That's right.
1971.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about that and how it developed.
Well, it was kind of strange, but I have an old sort of a hobby, I guess you'd call it. I like to collect old magazines. And somebody sent me the London Illustrated News of 1926. And there were two photographs on opposing pages that kind of really fired my imagination. And the first was the one that I'm sure you'll recognize, the famous shot of the rather bedraggled man in the middle of Berlin during the Weimar Republic. And he was holding the handles of a wheelbarrow filled with money. And the money in that wheelbarrow could barely buy a loaf of bread. Now, on the very next page was a shot of the Marienplatz in Munich. And there were thousands of what they call, and my German is not good, the Schulstefein, I believe is what they were called. They were known as the Army of Shovelers, and the word is very appropriate. They were the precursor of the Nazi Party. And they were all dressed in what we call Sam Brown belts. They had identical khaki trousers and shirts, and they carried shovels. And I kept going back and forth to these two photographs, thinking, now if a wheelbarrow full of money can hardly buy a loaf of bread, who in God's name paid for all those shovels and all that leather and all that identical khaki? And because I have a natural distrust of multinational finance, I decided to blame World War II on them. And so that's how it happened. That was really quite true. That was the nerd, the germ of it, and that's what happened.
How long did it take you to write this Scarlatti Inheritance?
Well, we blocked out about 18 months. In the meantime, sending applications to various universities.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me about a year, 13, 14 months to write it.
And your wife was very patient with you, working at home, I
understand. Yeah, I think it drove her a little crazy, well, the kids and me and what have you. But she's always been enormously supportive. And I'll never forget the time when I said, I really want to write. And she looked at me and said, well, you're 40 years of age. If you don't start now, you may regret it as long as we live, no matter how impoverished we may be.
The book had an immediate success.
I was very lucky, very, very lucky. Yeah.
The reviews were good, the sales were good.
Yeah.
Was Random House the publisher?
No, it was way back when, World Publishing.
World?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they're around anymore.
I may have put them out of business, I'm not sure.
I don't see how. You probably kept them in business longer than they should have been. What happened next? A series of books began to develop.
Yeah, I wrote a second book, and that's the hardest thing in the world to do, is the second book. The first, I think anybody can write a first book. I think a book is in everyone. We've all got a story we want to tell. The difference between, I think, a professional and perhaps an unprofessional is the second book. And I finally got one out, and a third book. And then I kind of knew I was a professional then. It was what I wanted to do all my life anyway. But it was the second and third books more or less let me feel that I was, you know, I'm okay. Now I'm in the business I really want to be in.
Your books, of course, are global in nature.
Yeah.
They sprawl all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
Are you yourself a traveler? Is this
yes.
Where you get all this information?
Enormous traveler.
Mm-hmm.
It's perhaps it was because, and you just brought out something I never thought of before, but why did Mary and I suddenly decide to travel, and why do the books look like this, and why am I sort of almost travelogging sometimes? I think perhaps the confining nature of theater, that you go only where the work is, and the fact that you are totally at the command and at the mercy of employment, unless you're a star, of course, which I never got near any heavenly thing whatsoever, then I think maybe the sudden freedom, suddenly we began to travel like mad, generally with the kids, I must say. And I think that opened a whole thing for me. And I think that's perhaps why the books take on a kind of an international flavor that way.
When you approach a book,
mm-hmm.
when you decide to write one, you have the idea, you have the theme, and mm-hmm. the character's pretty well developed. How do you go about actually putting it on paper? Or do you have a word processor?
No, my secretary does.
Mm-hmm.
I'm afraid to walk into the room. It scares the hell out of me.
Do you dictate?
I write by longhand. Actually, when I was in the theater in all those years of business, and it is a business, I typed very well. But when I left the theater, I sort of made a conscious decision that if I could make a living writing, I wanted no machine between me and that eventuality. And so I learned to write on legal pads. And that's what I do to this day. And my wife typed my first three books. And then we sort of realized that she didn't really have to then. And so we hired our first typist. And then, of course, we moved and we have another typist now.
Handwritten trash. And if that happened to me, I couldn't possibly read it myself.
Well, I don't know how Marianne reads it either, but she manages to turn hieroglyph into, you know, legible typing.
How do you lay it out? Do you use index cards? Yeah, your books are extremely complex and mm-hmm. detailed,
mm-hmm.
and it must... Obviously, it takes a great deal of imagination to be able to put something like this together, but you have to do a lot of planning, I would assume.
Oh, a fair amount. It's kind of strange, because I do a fairly detailed outline of anywhere from 50 to 100 pages. My wife reads it, my agent reads it, my editor reads it. And after they get finished yelling at me, I do whatever fixings that I think are right. And finished, all right, page one. The odd thing is that I never look at that outline again, except for certain areas where there's very detailed data on something. I think it's just because it sets up signposts in my head. And I don't have the... I don't want to be confined to any outline. But I really do know the beginning I pretty much know the end of my personal statement. Whether that statement is conveyed to anyone is not terribly important, but it's got to be the spine, as we used to call it in the theater. The spine of the book is there, which is my statement. What happens in between, I think, is often dictated by the development as it takes place.
Multiple drafts?
Used to be.
Time to knock it out with a single draft?
Oh, no. I do an awful lot of editing as I go along. I get up at, 4:15 in the morning, and I work at 4:30, and I'll work through most of the morning, and then in the afternoon I'll read what I've done, and if I don't throw up, then I just start editing and this and that.
But you must be, obviously, you must be pleased with your work, especially as you see the acceptance and the sales.
Yeah,
sort of.
It's funny. I think that I'm not satisfied. I'm never satisfied. You try to make each book better than the last. That's the major competition that you have. If you were a dedicated writer, it's not what other people are doing. It's what you yourself are doing. And writing, contrary to I think what many people have said, becomes much more difficult. It doesn't become easier.
The Osterman, The Weekend, that was made to a motion picture not too long ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, they sent me a tape, and I immediately scheduled a trip to the Far East so that we wouldn't be here when it opened.
Well, I wondered about that, because the reviews were not very kind, because I did not see the movie, so I'm not making any judgment myself, but the reviews I read indicated that the storyline was too complex, and it didn't translate
it was in the movie, yes. I think of all the books I've written, Osterman Weekend probably has the simplest and cleanest line of all.
Yeah.
But, and I have great respect for Sam Peckinpah, and I think what happened, as I understand, I read an article or an interview that he had with somebody, that he apparently had enormous fights with the producers. And I'm not one of these writers that, start crying about what they've done about your book into a movie, because one, you can always say no and don't take the money. And two, if you want to have certain controls, you can impose yourself on that. I do not have any talent for motion picture screenwriting or anything like that. And nobody starts out to make a bad picture.
That's
nobody.
Strange for you to say that with your background in the theater.
That's theater. That's not screen.
There's a certain interchangeability, though.
Well, there is in terms of dialogue. But dialogue is so much lessened in the motion picture medium. I can tell you a very interesting story about that. There's a novelist and a playwright who went to Hollywood many, many years ago. Great friend of mine. And he was stuck. He was working on a picture called International Settlement with John Howard and someone else. And he was trying to show a disintegrating marriage. And he was a playwright and a novelist. And he would start, and, it just went on for minutes and minutes. And they told him he had to do it in like 20 seconds. Well, now, for him, this was impossible. This was just, it was beyond the range of his thinking. And an old warhorse screenwriter came in and said, "What is it, Johnny?" And he told the man a story, and he said, you're in a business office here, right?" He said, "Yes, sir." "You got an elevator, right?" "Yes, sir." "All right, this is what you do. Man and wife walk in the elevator, man keeps hat on. They push button for 12th floor. Elevator stops at 3rd floor. Pretty blonde walks in, man takes hat off."
Mm-hmm.
You see, I don't have the skill or the talent or the imagination for that kind of thing.
Do you set deadlines for yourself? You'd like to have a book out every other year?
Every other year, yeah.
Like clockwork. Do you have a specific time of the month or of the year when you'd like to have the book come out?
No. It's been coming out from March all the time, I think. But that's really, I think that's the wish of my agent, who I think he's probably saying, "Let's not mess too much with a little success." So
that's right. Well, he's got a good thing.
Oh, yeah.
Do you like being put together, grouped together with Ken Follett and Lynn Dayton? I mean, I always picture you as part of that.
This is such a bromide that, labels are so misleading sometimes. I don't think I'm any more like Mr. Follett than he is like me, or Dayton, or Le Carré. I think we're all different, and Forsyth. I think we all write different things. There may be a genre kind of connection, but we all do different approaches. We're not similar.
Since you write the large, complicated, sweeping, international, intrigued novels, what do you like to read for pleasure. You don't read those, do you?
Oh, Don, I'll tell you. Somebody asked me on a television show once to name my favorite writers. So I aimed about 10 people. I got home and the phone rang for 3 weeks straight saying, "Hey, you SOB, what about me?" So I always say I like Dostoevsky, Dickens, Aristotle.
Well, what kind, what genre do you read?
I generally read nonfiction, frankly. Mm-hmm. I read a great deal of history. I love people like Barbara Tuchman, you know, and not a great deal of fiction, because I think that one is prone. If one, I will never read the same kind of book that I write, same genre, while I'm writing, because I think subconsciously mean things can happen. But one time, a friend of mine, one of the most honorable men I've ever known in my life, fine writer. He and I were discussing ideas about a book, and we were just playing around. I said, you know, I had an idea I was thinking about, and this and that. We're talking about it. A year later, he called me up, and he said, "Hey, Robert, I want you to read a manuscript I finished." And I picked it up and read it. It was my idea, made into a book. Now, this man never meant it. He never meant it, not for a minute. He's too honest, too honorable, too nice. Subconsciously, this happened. And so I almost consciously stay away from, you know, even the possibility.
That's happened with music, too, where a composer has picked up a theme that somebody else subconsciously translated into his own.
Yeah. Yeah, my son's a professional musician, and he's told me stories. He told me a guy who has been working on commercials, which is a very lucrative musical field, as you know, suddenly brought in this thing that the agency thought was absolutely marvelous, but he'd stolen the whole musical theme from a very popular commercial of the year before. And so this can happen, and it can happen without any intent whatsoever.
Well, Robert Ludlum, somewhere over the years you moved from New Jersey to Connecticut, mm-hmm. and then out of Connecticut down to Florida. Where are you in Florida now?
Well, I'd rather not, on the Gulf Coast.
Yeah.
We haven't moved out of Connecticut. What we've done is we've moved to Florida for about 6.5, possibly 7 months of the year, for a very simple reason. I developed a silly little thing that one happens when one is in one's 50s, a little thing called, it's a form of arthritis, and the heat helps me a great deal. The cold makes me pretty miserable. And that in itself makes me miserable, because I love to ski. I've skied all my life. I love the snow and I love the winter, but it's not for old father anymore.
Certainly came back to New York on the right day.
Yeah, I don't know what happened, but I don't think Random House really intended this to happen. But we got off the plane on Sunday, and I said to my wife, "Let's turn around and go back." She said, "No, keep going."
You know, Dick Francis lives in Fort Lauderdale, and he does his writing there.
Yeah, I do. I'm now writing there, too. Yeah. It's wonderful to write, at least where the climate is what I like and all that, and it's very pleasant.
Well, I know you said you were exhausted. You've been going since early this morning. I hope this is your last interview. And that you can go someplace tonight and have a drink and some dinner and relax.
Oh, gee, that'd be nice. Thank you, Don.
So I want to... did I cover everything?
No, I think you've done marvelously well. I just hope that I've responded in some way adequately.
Oh, you certainly have. I know that your readers are going to enjoy reading about the warlord of Saigon, and... it was certainly a pleasure having you in, and I hope I didn't make it too rough on you.
Not at all. As I say, I'm quite a fan of yours. I listen to the BookBeat all the time.
I didn't know anybody listened to the show.
Oh, I could tell. Well, WNOG in Naples knows.
I'm going to have to speak to them about that.
Yeah.
Where's my 50 cents?
Yes.
That's a beautiful town, Naples.
Oh, I love it. Love it. Yeah.
Spent a couple of summers in my college days down there. I like that Sanibel Island.
Oh, yes, sure.
Yeah. I guess they have a causeway to Sanibel, but when I was down there, they only had a ferry.
Yeah, no, there's a causeway now. Yeah.
So what's your schedule? Where do you go next?
We're going L.A., Los Angeles, tomorrow morning.
Tomorrow?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. You staying here in Manhattan? Yeah.
Yeah.
What are you staying when you're in town?
The Helmsley Palace. Yes.
Slumming, huh?
Yeah. I'll tell you, we've got a suite. We could go for a week without seeing each other. It's marvelous.
Well, Random House is picking up the tab.
I gather, yes. Of course, I'll know tomorrow morning, won't I?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.